Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Do you need a CPA that you can trust with all your taxes and financial needs? Look no further than Joanne Flash Fleming at Fleming & Associates CPA. For more info, go to flashfleming.com or email Joanne directly at joannflemming@flashfleming.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This is Cynthia Cherish Malloran, Reverend DJ Cherish the Love, and you are listening to Primary Food on Heritage Radio Network. So before I forget, let me tell you how to reach out to me and get my attention on social media, Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at DJ Cherish the Love. That's love spelled L-U-V. And hashtag using Primary Food, Heritage underscore radio, and hashtag RevLove. So what exactly is Primary Food? I learned this really great concept in nutrition school at IIN, the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, that the food you eat, you know, the stuff we put in our mouths and chew and enjoy, we consider that secondary food. Primary food is everything else in life that nourishes us before we sit down and eat. And that's stuff like enjoying music, reading a book, hanging out with friends, cooking food, a great job, creative expression, playing games, exercise, and so on. And I'm so glad that I learned this because it was the high quality primary food that I kept in my life while going through chemotherapy last year that kept me happy and healing my cancer. So Primary Food is produced by Heritage Radio Network, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food. Help keep HRN alive by becoming a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate now. Do it now. Or do it later at the end of the show. Either way, I'll love you forever. And seriously, we need you. And it feels really good to be needed, right? So we are in the fourth season of Primary Food, pretty deep into it. And today's guest, I'm so excited about, is HRN's very own Jennifer Luzzi, host of Tech Bites. She's joining me today in today's episode of Primary Food. We're so focusing on the search for a great job as our primary food theme. We're going to discuss my search for work that nourishes my soul and the wild journey of this woman in this world of judgment, sexism, and Photoshop, and so on. It's kind of the follow-up episode, to episode 36, I think it is, with Libby Moore, Oprah Winfrey's chief of staff. We're going to continue to bring light to the importance of listening to oneself and not being afraid to change careers. Sometimes you're even forced to change. I've got a few stories about that. So I'm calling today's episode, How Did You Get Here? How Did I Get Here? And Jen, I'm happy to have you here. I know how you got here.
I got here on the L train.
You know, we've been wanting to, Jen and I have been wanting to hang out since the Women's March.
Since before that. Since from when you came on board over a year ago, I think.
Yes,
and we discovered that we were probably the two exclusive Filipinas on the network.
We're peas in a pod.
Yes.
And here we are today.
Plus the short hair don't care crew.
That's right.
Which you can't see on radio, but it looks good.
It looks really good. And it's, you know what? Talk about no maintenance.
Yeah, zero maintenance.
Like, really zero maintenance. And I have so much extra time in my life. Think about it. Collectively?
Yes.
Over
years,
decades?
Years and years.
We have like added weeks to our life. So we're going to turn the tables a bit today. Jen is going to be doing more of the interviewing and me the answering, which is so exciting for me. It leaves me very vulnerable. It's very exciting.
I like asking a lot of questions.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. I feel very blessed that you're here today.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm glad it worked out.
Yeah.
It's also strange to be in the other seat.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. You're in that seat.
The guest seat.
In the dark seat in the studio. So we're also going to be having some music in today's episode as usual, because I've been blessed with a wonderful gift of music from Ubiquity Records in Costa Mesa. They've granted me permission to spin their entire discography on the air and out wherever I gig, which is pretty incredible. So during our little music breaks, that's what you'll be hearing, music that's actually quite rare. I'll be dusting it off and giving it a new life. So Ubiquity Records is located in Costa Mesa, California, with their satellite office in San Francisco. And they have two imprint labels, Love and Hate, specializing in rare groove, and Cubop Records, specializing in Latin jazz and salsa. So including all three imprints, the label has released over 350 albums covering genres from reggae to Latin jazz. Awesome. So, Jen, I guess you're taking it from here.
That's my cue?
And is that your cue? That's your cue.
Well, coincidentally, I listened to the Libby Moore episode.
Thank you.
Libby Moore on her Gypsy Tour, formerly the Oprah Winfrey Chief of Staff.
So glad you listened.
She was great. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed her. And so I have a little bit of a sense of how you want to continue the conversation. And one of the things that I really noted about Libby, and it's certainly what she does now in life, is that she's a coach and a mentor and a speaker. So I think part of her job is really asking people questions, and maybe questions they may have even heard before, but coaxing out a different answer or a more profound answer, or maybe helping them find the answer.
Mm.
I think finding the answer is something that we struggle with and search for and almost like carry the burden of that in life if you're, you know, informed and awake and striving for something, you know, searching for the right answer on so many levels in life, my job, what am I having for dinner, my partner, my sport, my vote.
Do you feel, do you believe that we always have the answer?
Yes, I do.
I do too.
I think the asking the question is, I think asking the question many times is just reminding you that it's there. And I think asking the question and answer process is also just to help articulate confidence sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to start off, because I don't want to meander too much, I know that the idea is, how did I get here and how did you get here and how did you get to the career and the job and the place you have in life? And I know that it's also just important as the theme of this show to be receiving, you know, nourishment and happiness in life through all these different activities. So having your job be a source of nourishment and happiness in your life is, I think, what we want to talk about.
It is. I mean, at 40 years old right now, I am professionally a DJ and a reverend who officiates weddings. That is not what I studied.
No, I can't imagine that it is. Although it could have been, although I know you, so I know
it
that's
isn't.
Not what you did. So the way I think, we talked about this sort of workshopping it a little bit before the show started, you know, asking that question of having a great job, being happy in your job. I think the first part of deconstructing that question is, what does happiness and great mean to you? Because the 40-year-old you, who's traversed a lot of different things, is probably very different from the 20-year-old you and the 30-year-old you and the 5-year-old you who woke up in the morning in your parents' house and dreamed of what they were going to do someday. So, you know, sometimes being able to articulate all the specifics of the question to identify in a much clearer fashion what your actual goal is, then makes it easier for you to get there. Because happiness is so specific to individual people. So I would ask you, first off, do you feel like your jobs, nourish you and give you happiness?
Finally, they do.
Yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, finally, in this age of my life, I mean, I am a different person than I was at 39-year-old me.
Yeah.
And 38, and so on and so on. But I've finally landed in a place where what I get paid to do is like, wow, I love it, finally.
So what is happiness to you? What is happiness, and then what is success to you? What is it about success? Does that mean you're earning enough money to support yourself in the lifestyle that you want to be supported in? So that's successful and happiness.
I just love that you're asking that, because that is the question that has been the thread through my life. It's like I've just been searching for this success. What is that? And it's been so fluid. It's changed. It's changed, as you said earlier when we were talking, there have been major paradigm shifts in my thinking of how of how what I do nourishes me, and is it nourishing me, and am I doing it? Am I, quote, successful? I guess if I look back at the very, very beginning, when I was 5 years old or 6 years old, I loved playing with scissors.
Most of us do.
If I get paid to play with scissors, that would be success. Just simple as that.
So then did you want to cut hair or work in fashion or work in art or work in something where you were using scissors all day? God. Did that even occur to you or no?
Great question. I wanted to. And my family can totally back me up on this. I would take the church bulletins, the newspapers, cut them up and rearrange them. I wanted to work in newspapers. I wanted to work in what I didn't know was called graphic design when I was a kid. My parents saw me with scissors and they wanted me to become a surgeon. Well, you know, I'm Filipino-American.
Right.
There's only three jobs you can have. Surgeon, lawyer, architect.
Yeah. Filipinos do fall into the Asian stereotype of tiger parents.
Oh, yeah. It's doctor, lawyer, architect, preferably surgeon. Okay, so that is what they kind of like were molding me for in success in my life.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in New York City and went to most of my years Catholic schools.
So your frame of reference for success as a five-year-old was urban New York City.
Yeah, yeah. And doctors.
And doctors.
Doctors. My mom was a nurse, so that counts too. That would be successful, yet not as successful as doctor. Not as good. You know, and to some degree, they're right. I mean, that is a highly paid profession, all of those things. My mom is a nurse. My dad was an engineer. So that was their information. To explain to them in high school that, you know what, I'm taking these art classes because I want to become an artist. Oh my God. It was like they kind of wanted to like disown me. Just like, no, you're so smart. You need to be a lawyer. My values didn't lie there. I wanted to do something else.
You know, your values didn't lie there. I mean, from one point of view, was it the value of the profession unto itself, or was it simply you wanted to do something that made you happy while you were doing it?
That's,
did you take science classes and math classes?
I did.
Were they fun for you or
no,
enjoyable?
They weren't at all. Like, at all. Now they would be, for some reason. I find it fascinating. But back then, and I was also going to this like really stiff all-girls Catholic school that was like a college prep kind of a school. So things were just kind of being forced my way. And I learned early on not to listen to myself. I knew from then, like, I don't want to do this, but I guess I don't know better. Because everyone else, adults, telling me what I need to become when I grow up. But I still wasn't finding myself filling out those applications for those schools. I was applying to art schools. So I started going to colleges, taking graphic design classes. Photography and graphic design and advertising was where I gravitated towards. No surprise there.
Like, but you were listening to yourself then, because you were pursuing...
I was quasi-listening to myself.
Well, you were pursuing the subjects that you were studying that made you happy, but you were also had the same value of wanting to have a college education, pursue more learning, and, you know, go through that process. So that was something that actually did align with your parents' view of more education and advanced degrees.
I think that was the compromise.
You just had a different subject. Would you have not gone to college?
I definitely would have. I would have definitely first applied to different colleges, but then I my first college that I applied to was St. John's University, which had a pharmacology program too, where I was like, Mom and Dad, don't worry, I'll take some art classes and that, I promise. Which of course I didn't. And I kept applying to other schools, to art schools. And finally, I went through Pratt. I went through, like, my parents were like, if you want to go to art school, you have to, you know, get a scholarship. And I was like, I'm going to have to get a scholarship. So I actually got a scholarship to SVA.
There you go.
Major scholarship. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to keep pursuing this and get my advertising degree. And I think I'm going to be very good at this because I got a scholarship.
You wanted to go to college anyway, in spite of your parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you didn't want to be antithetical to what they wanted just out of spite.
I guess I knew a college degree would be a good thing. I could have easily gone the route of I'm just going to be like totally not going to school. But
so I
needed that.
I think
that.
It might be interesting to just take a pause and consider that it's also okay if what you want is the same thing
sure.
as what other people want.
Sure.
Even if it's only a part of their story.
Yeah.
Your parents
yeah.
wanted you to go to college.
Yeah.
They wanted you to be a specific doctor, lawyer, person. You might have eased the tension a little bit if, you know, you were able to say, yeah, I want to go to college too. And you want me to go to college too. So we actually have common ground there. Because you don't have to always be 100% in opposition to the people you think aren't listening to you.
That's very true. And you're making me realize now something that had happened because I kind of, you know, I did listen to them. I'm a respectful kid. I finished college, got my degree.
You can be respectful and disagree.
True.
And
true.
You can be disagreeable and like still agree on some points.
That's very, very true. What I find that it did for me then was no matter what, in my early years, my 20s and my career building and where I worked and so on, my values then shifted. It shifted into, I need to prove to my parents that I did the right thing and make as much money as possible and succeed to prove to them.
So that became your definition of success?
In my 20s.
At that point in time?
Yeah. And it was pretty horrible. Because what I ended up doing was, so I got a job at a major ad agency.
Well, it was probably horrible because I'm sure you didn't share with them the idea that you were going to go out and do all these things to make your point and make them happy. And if all they wanted was doctor, lawyer, you know, architect, anything outside of that, it
not
probably would
enough.
Have been a tough sell.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
you sort of set yourself up to be perpetually like pushing up against a brick wall.
Girl,
in your own little, you know, cone of silence.
Yeah, and that
so
was,
you were the only one who knew you were struggling.
I didn't even know I was struggling. This is the part that's so interesting. I knew that I just had to keep achieving and achieving and achieving, and that must be success. And I'm getting paid. And I'm finding myself working 63, 65-hour weeks as a 20-year-old person.
Were you happy?
No.
Were you making a lot of money?
76 grand a year at 20.
Were your parents happy with that?
I don't think they were.
Did they know?
Or they could have been. But in my head, they would have never been happy. And this is part of the nasty cycle that kept happening in my 20s, where I kept burning myself out because my values were like, well, what's success?
Was there anybody around you who thought you were successful?
Everyone.
The people you worked with?
Absolutely.
Your friends?
Absolutely.
Were your friends in advertising also?
A few of them were, yeah. Yeah.
So they thought you were doing great?
I was doing pretty great. If I look back now, like, I would like to be back there. But I was not happy because I was chasing something so strange that was not like what I needed to fulfill myself.
Did you have any, what was your life like outside of advertising? Did you have a sport or your music or your friends? Or was it one of those?
Nothing.
Get up, go to work, come home.
65-hour weeks.
Yep.
Car service there and back.
Mm-hmm.
20 years old, doing that over and over and over again.
What'd you do with all the money?
That's a great question. I need to say this. I'm so glad I did that because after going through cancer treatment last year, that's how I spent the money.
You saved it.
I saved it.
Good for you.
I invested it.
You invested it?
Yeah, I invested it, and I'm a proud Apple stock owner.
Good for you.
In that time, I succeeded in those ways, but I wasn't happy. Find out why I wasn't happy. The actual workplace and the assignments were fulfilling and challenging, or maybe not. Actually, when I think about it, I was doing a lot of work, and it was a lot of work that I didn't agree with. And this was something I also found in my late 20s and then 30s, where I'd be doing projects that were kind of didn't feel right. And I wasn't listening to myself to be like, stop working here then. I was working on accounts where I became a professional retoucher, and I was putting those subliminal messages into ads.
Like, wow.
Smiley faces into, I'm not going to name the brands, but big brands.
Yep.
They'd have me retouch
things.
You're
the big brother.
I was doing all that stuff I hate. And being a retoucher and getting paid really a lot of money to do it. Over the years, I would end up doing really weird jobs that I really hated in my soul.
Like, but you were making a lot of money.
Oh my God.
So it felt like it was okay.
Chasing $1,000 bill invoices at a time. It felt great. It felt successful. It felt like, isn't this how I should be feeding my life? But going home and sitting and doing the work and then going to the office, I was doing things like, one of my clients was the New York Fireman's Calendar.
Oh.
So I'd be putting abs on bodies that had flab. It was like one of my jobs. And I'm like, this isn't right. Then I worked for a major music label, and I was retouching people to be skinnier all the time. Mm. I ended up working in, this is where I had a paradigm shift, a big time one, working in children's educational publishing. And I was asked to make this black girl lighter.
Oh, dear.
In educational national textbook.
Nice.
I was doing things like that, but getting well paid and thinking like, why am I doing this? Oh, for the money. And that's what's feeding me. Right.
So you were doing a lot of things. It sounds like that were very positive and very good and actually exactly what your parents wanted you to do.
Yeah.
You had a regular job. You were making a lot of money.
Yeah.
You were being smart and investing it and saving it instead of just, you know, throwing it all away like you could have back then in those days. I'm assuming this
I
is
threw
sort of
some
like
of it away.
The 80s and the 90s in New York.
Some
like,
of it away.
Little bright lights, big city. little Charvari. Old people will know what I'm talking about. The young kids will be like, Char, what? You were doing that. You were successful in your trade. You were working with bigger and better clients. You were making more and more money. So on paper, all these things, you're doing great.
Yeah. But
the outlying, the big component, because all those things on paper, that's a lot of stuff that's really going your way that theoretically should have made you very happy.
Yeah.
But the overriding component, which could not turn all of those things into happiness, was the intellectual and emotional piece, which you felt the work you were doing was wrong or harmful or hurtful.
I knew it was. I knew it was.
Not good to put out into the world.
I'll tell you how I knew it was wrong and not good and toxic. And I'm not bashing a little bit, maybe.
Just a little
like
bit, maybe.
Commercial,
yeah.
You know, the
no,
commercial.
No, they can stand.
You can take it.
They
okay.
can take a
the
bashing.
The industry can take it.
You know, absolutely.
It's kind of fucked up.
It's totally fucked up in many instances.
Very artificial. And I didn't realize the effect it was having on me to be a professional retoucher until I went through this phase of I could not share a picture of myself until I retouched it.
Oh, boy.
In Photoshop.
So the... Yeah.
That was deep.
The industry of advertising and image became the yardstick that you measured everything, including yourself.
It poisoned me.
So what was it that made you realize or wake up or smell the coffee or whatever euphemism you want to use? Was there a single moment?
Yeah.
Was it a gradual? What was that
moment?
It was
a gradual, like a gradual stomach ache, I guess, of sorts.
Right.
But then I got to this point where I was having an anxiety attack. And this was several years ago, maybe 8 years ago or so. where I was having a real panic attack, anxiety attack about, oh my God, did someone take a picture of me and post it on Facebook? Oh. And I was like, what is wrong with me? And I realized, okay, I sat with myself and I was like, what's wrong with that? And in my head, I was like, I didn't get to
Photoshop it.
And I was like, whoa, something's wrong. And I scaled back and I was like, what is wrong here?
So before you jump to the scaling back, do you remember what you actually did when you say, I sat with myself for a little while?
Yeah.
What did you do?
I literally sat, nothing in my hands, in my room. I remember it, the light, it was great. It was just sitting there and questioning myself and talking to myself in a way I hadn't talked before. I never used to be like, Cynthia, why? You know, I was sitting like, why? Wait, why? Because part of the anxiety I was having, I saw was affecting my then husband at the time. I was like ruining the mood of the room. And I was like, what's happening here? Like, what am I doing? And why is this happening? I sat and literally questioned like what this feeling is. Cause I was kind of getting sick of it. And even though I was getting paid so well to do this kind of stuff, I knew more and more and more, I soon would not be able to take it.
So how long did the conversation with yourself last in the room?
You know, I would say a few minutes of sitting and then a few minutes of not thinking at all and just sitting and feeling like shit.
And then what did you do when you were finished talking to yourself?
Wow, what a great question. What did I do? I didn't do anything immediately.
You got up and...
I think I must have just gotten up and like walked around the rest of my day thinking something's wrong.
And then what was the first action that you took to change? After that,
it's amazing.
And how long? And how long did it come? Was it a couple of days? Was it Monday? Was it?
I would say it was definitely that same summer. The first action that happened to change me was not by choice or voluntary. I got into an accident.
Oh,
yeah, I got into a pretty bad accident in Sweden, and I had broken my shoulder, my knee, my four front teeth.
Wow,
and I sustained a very severe concussion. So after that concussion, I suffered from something for about 2 years called post-concussion syndrome, which is basically an amnesia of sorts.
Wow.
So that change came about. I came back to the States not knowing how to do my job.
That's amazing. How long were you in Sweden recovering?
I went from Sweden to Denmark and flew back from Denmark, and I recovered in the States. And nobody, not my clients, nobody knew. I had friends who, 2 years later, were still looking for me. And I didn't know this was happening. I lost my career, everything. I had three computers on my desk that I remember it was such a fog because, like, amnesia is for real. So when I was healing and going through that, I remember a point where I looked at my desk and saw three computers, quite dusty, and me going, I must have been good at whatever I used to do. I turned the computer on, and there were 7,998 emails.
Wow.
And I'll never forget that number. I was just like, oh, so many emails.
Do you play that number in Lotto?
No, but I should, right?
Yeah, or write it down somewhere.
I should do something with 7,998.
Or like do that numerology thing where you add it up together and then you get your horoscope
number
in the back of the magazine.
I hope it wins me something because that's a really stellar number for me. Because I remember sitting there going, wow, and I was scrolling through. And what I understand now are like clients. Like I didn't invoice for things. Like I was gone for 2 years. In that 2 years time, I also didn't fully understand who my husband was anymore. And I filed for a divorce shortly after because this stranger was coming into my apartment, putting their key in the door. And I was like, who is this person? So like barely intellectually, I knew who he was, but the real sense of who he wasn't with me anymore. And it still isn't. I was with him 11 years.
Wow.
And I don't have, it was literally knocked out of my head. I hit my head on the road three times. My ex-husband saw me hit my head on the road three times at high speed. And it really was the change. So that was this paradigm shift.
Cataclysmic event.
I don't know how I survived that. Because that kind of sport accident, a lot of people don't survive something even a third as
rough as that. But that I hit my head without a helmet on a road three times, knocked my teeth out and all of that. I don't know how I got through it, but it took years and years and years of healing. And then I was like, what do I do?
So the last thing you remember was being really unhappy with your life,
yeah,
professionally, yeah, financially successful, but emotionally and personally very unhappy.
Yeah.
And then you go away, you have this cataclysmic accident that wipes away your memory of your career and your marriage.
Yeah.
And you
and a lot
are
of things.
Absolutely just forced,
yeah,
by the experience to hit the reset button.
And why that accident happened was I was in a hurry to get back to work.
That's amazing.
It's really, really interesting. So I knew previously, things have come back to me and I remember a lot of things. Some things not good and I wish you don't remember those things, but sometimes you remember these things.
A good memory can be a gift and a curse.
Yeah. Bad memories too. So I remember feeling like, you know, I had, as a freelancer at that point, chasing that happiness or that success, I was working around the clock. I had clients on the West Coast and all the way as far as China. So I was sleeping like 3 or 4 hours a night and thinking I'm successful. This is what I do, right? And somehow I knew I wasn't happy. I actually recall wishing there was a change. But careful what you wish for.
Exactly. So what did you do for work when you came back to New York and woke up from your amnesia but still didn't have quite a sense of what you were doing and what you had done?
I didn't work for years. I couldn't because I didn't know what I could do.
And
it's wild.
Where was your family's point of view at this stage in terms of what you felt they wanted for you in life?
I think that
or would hope for you to have in life.
I remember my dad saying he just wanted me to be happy and like find what I needed to do and heal because I'd gone through this thing, right? Which is then a few years later, I go through cancer and this is exactly what my dad says too. This is like the lesson now, you know,
right.
Just find that thing you love to do that feeds you. I was working all the time and not being fed. I was starved of experience, of joy, of all of it. But, you know, like we said earlier, like the money that I made then helped me have that cushion to recover from these horrible things. Like that accident, I basically was spending my savings living, but because I had savings from the way I was working before. So my parents at this stage were just like, you know, just be happy and healthy because you're going through this thing. And I was lost. I mean, I didn't understand my own talents. I had to rediscover so many things over the last many years.
So how did you do that? Your discovery process?
Wow, this discovery process is so amazing because you just sit in front of things and then you find, holy crap. Here's a great example of that. I got a piano because I wanted to learn. And when the piano was delivered that night, I was playing songs and I was like, I knew how to play the piano. I didn't know that. I was at a friend's place and he was like, you know, why don't you take a hot bath? You're not feeling great. You're hurting because I had aches. He runs the bath and I'm looking at him like, the hell do you do with that? And he's like, get in. I was like totally unaware of what a bathtub was in that moment. So all of these like brain healings had to happen for me to get kind of like moving again. I was stuck in this place where like, just like absolutely stuck.
So at what point, healing from the cataclysmic accident, do you feel like you had recreated a sense of a life and who you are and what you were doing? Did you start working again for money at some point? No.
No. It's so interesting that you say that because in that reset, that's the big major reset of
right.
my life. Everything got wiped away from me. All responsibility, like things like job, like that.
Right.
So I was left with what makes me happy. So now I need to find what makes me happy. And if there's a way to make money doing that, then I'm going to find that way. I would have never, or it would have taken a lot for me to find the bravery to do that consciously without being forced to do it.
Right.
But I'm here to say that when you do that, it's really amazing.
I think the interesting thing about the, you know, sort of the void that you had after your accident when we go back to how you build the idea or the picture of what the great job would be or what your successful career looks like, most people are using inputs from a lot of different sources. You're yeah. using the inputs from what your parents told you. You're using inputs from how their success is judged, your siblings, other family. You're using the inputs from socially yeah. what's successful right now. It used to be if you made $1 million and you were a millionaire, you were super successful. And if you could make $1 million and had the nut, and then you could, you know, cash it in and retire and get out. And that number is now, you know, multiplied exponentially of the amount of money that you have to have. So you have society plugging in numbers, yeah. you have yeah. the media plugging in things, and then you have your peer group, who your friends are in life, the people you associate with at work. And all those things plug in information into what you say, this is what I think success is. You had a very interesting situation where all of that was removed and you were in like a cone of silence and you were left to your own devices. And the only thing you really had to listen to was a visceral reaction.
Absolutely.
A lot of times I think, and this goes to, you know, inspiring people to go out and maybe make a change in their life. A lot of people have decision-making anxiety and decision angst. They want to think about things and evaluate and, you know, well, what does this mean? What does that mean? Where am I going to be? Where am I going to get? Yeah. What is other people? What's this? What are they going to say? You know, and sift through all those different things. I often ask people, like when I asked you, yes or no?
Uh-huh.
Yes or no? Just go with your gut. What's your first reaction? I like this. I don't like this. This is good. This is not good. I'm happy with this. I'm satisfied with this. And you had to do that in a vacuum.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which most people don't have the luxury of doing that. And a lot of times people, I think we try to solve problems by adding things. I'm going to solve this problem if I can get more money, if I can get more stuff, if I can get more hours with my trainer, if I can get a better job, if I can get this, if I can get that, if
Absolutely.
I can add,
Absolutely.
It will be better. But what you did is you were forced to solve the problem by removing.
Exactly.
If you could only come to a decision, or if you could only solve a problem by eliminating things, what would those things be? Because when you eliminate
yeah.
things and you get it down to the core of what is fundamental to have in life, that's when you reach the point of, this is what makes me happy. Because all the rest of it yep. is just superfluous.
That is exactly how I operate now. You know, mm-hmm. just like that.
It's sort of like doing a Marie Kondo for your life.
Exactly. And it was forced upon me.
Yes.
So we'll take a little music and sponsor break, and then we'll come back and talk about now, you know, what's going on now?
Do you need a CPA that you can trust with all your taxes and financial needs? Look no further than Joanne Flash Fleming at Fleming & Associates CPA. For more info, go to flashfleming.com or email Joanne directly at joannfleming@flashfleming.com.
So we're discussing listening to ourselves, right? And
yeah, we're discussing a lot of things. I think we're trying to find an idea of a roadmap to take us to the place where we have a great job, which is a source of nourishment and happiness. And my hypothesis at the top of the show is that in order to get to that great place of happiness, you need to first be able to define what will give you deep happiness and deep satisfaction. And a part of that hypothesis is that will change over time as you grow older, as you have different experiences, as life takes away your memory or, you know, puts you in different situations. And you have had a very unusual and amazing two experiences in your life that where you have literally, you know, touched your own mortality. First with the accident that you had where, you know, not only physically was it something you had to recover from in an intense way, but it took your memory, which is amazing. And then after that, your experience with cancer, which is being faced with your own mortality, which being faced with mortality gives you a sense of urgency like nothing else.
Oh,
and we've
yeah.
all...
yeah.
Many people experience it on a personal level like you. Some people experience it adjacently if they have loved ones or friends or family. But I think, you know, in order to get to that definition of what makes us happy, I propose the idea of removing everything that's superficial and superfluous, removing what people think they might want from you or what you think, you know, would look great on Instagram or what you think you're supposed to be doing, and start to, you know, the same way you would clean out your closet or Marie Kondo your kitchen or, you know, all those kinds of things. At the end, what would be the most important thing to you? If you only, and, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I read a lot of, I love those Seven Habits of like super successful, famous people, you know, how to be more efficient with your day, like keys to power and success. I'm a total sucker for that kind of clickbait on social media. And I listen to a lot of, you know, the podcasts and the things from the people and the speakers. One of the things they all have in common is they all ask these extreme questions and they make people try and solve a problem in an extreme situation in the hopes that it will stimulate a new idea. Mm-hmm. And I mean, for most of us, life is not so extreme as life and death. But if you ask an extreme question, that might, you know, bring something new. So if you could only do one thing, or if, you know, is it more important for you to make money or do good in the world? And if, you know, you start to answer questions like that, really viscerally, like, what's your gut reaction? Don't think about it.
Exactly.
What's your gut reaction? You can start to create boundaries for this idea and sort of narrow the field and get to what you want. Because I believe, truly, at the end of the day, nobody's going to care how many emails I sent. I, too, have worked in advertising and marketing and all that. No one cares about Super Bowl commercials, and those people aren't going to call you, and mm-hmm. they're not going to come visit you if you get amnesia and you're in the hospital. What are truly the things that are meaningful to you? Who are the people who are truly meaningful in your life? And if you wouldn't commit to spending time with that person for years to come, or you wouldn't commit to being in that office and flying the flag for that cause for the rest of your life, why would you spend any time doing
it? Amen to that.
And so it sounds like an extreme concept. But really, if you become much more strict about truly identifying the things that are meaningful to you, that make you happy, and you get rid of all the rest of the stuff, you're going to have so much more time to pursue those things.
It's
and
so
then
true.
You'll fill up the space of time with the things and the people that you truly love. I say no to stuff all the time from one point of view, because it's like, I don't want to go to another one of those things where I walk around and it's the things with the people and the chef and the whatever, and I'm going to see the same people and it's going to be, you know, 90 minutes out of my life. I'm going to go and I'm going to spend that time with, you know, a person who really means the world to me, or I'm going to go and I'm going to work on my sport and practice, you know, getting better, or I'm going to learn something and all of that. And, you know, my life has become smaller and a little bit simpler, but much happier.
I think that's super important. Like for me, you know, my reset allowed me to go after what I really wanted to do in the first place, was, which was to be creatively free, to do things that, where people were happy, be it dancing or getting married, you know, like things like that, where I felt joy instead of I made money. You know, like,
well, and also in your job as retoucher with all that, you know, sort of subliminal messaging and all those kinds of things, your job was to make people feel bad about themselves.
Precisely.
So they would buy something.
Precisely.
Which is a heavy load to bear.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just for sheer capitalism.
And I knew it. And I knew it doing it.
And
too.
And now you have turned, and I don't know if you actually articulate it in the way that your job is to make people happy and feel better about themselves, which is
Absolutely.
The exact counterpoint to what you were doing.
Jen, when I see people dancing at a gig I'm doing, and I think, well, if they were having a bad day, they're not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing to get
yep.
paid to do that.
Yep.
When I officiated this incredible gay wedding in Palm Springs last year, and I realized it was one of the happiest days of my life, and then I realized it was the happiest day of their lives, and I got paid for it, and I realized, okay, I'm finally on the right track.
Well, you're on the right track, and you're very fortunate that your track is also helping other people be on their track, because you have like the double extra whammy.
That's
on your
been
track,
important for me.
You know,
that's important.
I do think that not everybody, you know, when you define what your job is going to be, not everyone is fortunate to be able to have a job where they can impact other people's lives and have a job that does service and that, you know, is actually contributing to the greater good.
That's a great question.
And that's something that I think also, especially today with so much activism and social enterprise and awareness and, you know, working on the environment and myself and being vegan and organic and am I fit and am I healthy and is my food clean and, you know, is this fair trade coffee and are workers okay? And, you know, is this my car service going to be all right? And there's a lot of these very heavy intellectual, social goals and judgments that we set up for ourselves.
I think the
that
best,
people struggle with, I think, quite a bit.
I think if you're, you know, I think the best way to close this is just to understand that if you are feeling like you want to be doing more and you want to be more socially proactive in whatever way, then you should go do it. You should listen to that self and like, because it will feed your life and you will feed other people. I mean, there are going to be people who are like, no, I'm not interested in that. And I really just want to do this. And that's fine.
Or you're doing what?
No, they're just like, you know, doing whatever they're doing and they're feeling fine, but not interested in helping other people. There are going to be people who are fitting that bill, but that's fine. They're fine where they are. But if you have something in you that's like bubbling, like it was for me, and I didn't take the proactive steps to change it and it was forced upon me to change, I would say make those changes. Change is not scary. It's scarier to have change forced upon you, I think. But if you make those proactive changes, as I think you'll agree, to feed your life and to feed your psyche and to feed your emotions, you're going to be in a better off place.
Absolutely. And I think, again, to go back to the idea of a lot of times making change can be overwhelming for people, mm-hmm. Especially if you want to make a career change. It's one of the most stressful, big deal things you can do if you want to change a job, if you want to move the place you live, especially if there are places and jobs that you have zero experience in, it can be very overwhelming and people don't know how to get started. You know, sometimes, again, you know, stopping, taking a breath, taking a moment, and starting to go through and eliminating the things that you don't really like or that maybe you can't really afford. And it makes you feel bad to, you know, give up things to have them, or people who aren't kind to you, or people who, you know, aren't supportive of you. And maybe the first step in getting to that amazing job that you love that nourishes you is first to try and clear the path and clear the way and clear some space in your life, clear some space for your resources, your time and your energy, to then start to move towards them. Because sometimes it's hard to listen to yourself. Sometimes it's hard to see the path that is there for you if it's cluttered up with a bunch of crap
absolutely.
That bugs you that you don't like.
Oh my God, absolutely. So that's our challenge for you, listening.
Yeah. Try and solve a problem by eliminating things.
Yeah.
You know, just as an example, I have a lot of stuff. I'm a very lucky person. I have a lot of stuff. People are very generous. I have lots of clothes and shoes and handbags and beautiful things. And a couple years ago, you know, I was, you know, changing sizes and getting bigger and smaller. And I said, you know what? I don't actually need any more stuff. I don't need any more shoes. I don't need any more handbags. I don't need any more clothes. I'm going to stop shopping. And I'm going to stop shopping with the exception of, like, if I need gym clothes, because my current ones got, like, totally gross. But really only, like, functional gym clothes were, like, underwear or something like that on a total functional level. Because I had everything else. And I basically, you know, went through my stuff and triaged it. The only thing that I would allow myself was to recycle, where I would take clothes to, like, a consignment and then trade them in for other clothes. But I didn't buy anything. And I did that hard and fast for 2 years. And the thing that was amazing was, one, I had a huge amount of time that kind of opened up because I wasn't shopping anymore. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to a thing. I need to buy an outfit, or maybe I need clothes, or hey, it's springtime. We should go look at this. I stopped. I had a bunch of time. I sort of rediscovered and organized all the stuff that I did have. And I had a ton of money because I wasn't buying anything.
Yeah.
So even something as simple and seemingly non-impactful to my career or my job choice opened up time and money. And what can I do with that time and money? I can spend it on a trainer and go to the gym and practice my sport. I could spend it on taking a class to go and learn the thing that I want to do that I think is my great job. I could spend it, you know, my time volunteering someplace, something that I wanted to do. Your time and your money are your greatest assets.
Absolutely. That's actually, I was going to say, any final words? And I think that's it right there.
Your time and money are your greatest assets. And think about solving your problems by taking things away instead of adding.
I hope that has landed in you. That's what has happened to me. Things were taken away from me. And I got to start over. And I'm just going to close this with, don't be afraid to change voluntarily. And listen to that voice. Don't let yourself be in the space where you're not happy. You're being nourished for years and decades. I was there. Maybe you've experienced that too. So hopefully you've taken in what we've been talking about and heard my crazy story and see that maybe, you know, there's some things that need to be changed or some things that you can let go of in your life to start finding what makes you happy and freer. And Jen, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. And you should tell people where they can find you and where they can come find you when you play music, because it is true. It's amazing. It'll make you feel better.
Thank you. Yes, actually. And I forget to
always
say that.
I want to come the next time. I saw you posted something that you're going to be playing soon.
Yeah, I'll be at Drum. I started a band called PMS. Just because I wanted women to say, I love PMS.
Is that from your art director days? That's the color, the colors,
no,
the print colors?
Thing.
No, it's not the PMS
it's
colors
real
for
PMS
printing?
It's a real PMS kind of woman kind
sorry.
Of thing.
I didn't know if we were still in advertising.
That's happening at Drum this Thursday at 8 o'clock. And if you miss that, there will be more. But follow me on Instagram at DJ Cherish the Love to find out more about that. Thank you so much for being here, Jen.
Thank you for having me. This is great. I hope it was helpful.
Super helpful. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to Primary Food. Please come back for more.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.